to calm me down.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Feed Your Head. I'm Ruth Anna Marte-Theo. My first guest tonight is George Schieber. Hello, George.
Hi, how are you?
I
want to express a good Friday to everybody and a happy Passover to all our Jewish friends all around the world.
Exactly, because this is a very holy day for many, many people.
Many people, yes. And I was very impressed that the Pope kissed and washed the feet of so many different religions, not just Christian, on Holy Thursday. I was very impressed by that.
Okay, well, I think that people, while a lot of us describe ourselves as spiritual, not religious, still a lot of people have cultural ties and things to
absolutely
religious events. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. So I'm like you, you know, happy Good Friday. And then Easter is in 2 days. So, yeah, that's all good. Now, George, I want to start out because you will also, you're a host on Blog Talk Radio. You know,
yes,
find a lot of people, George Schieber lectures. But you have come from, you're Palestinian.
Yes.
And do you want to talk a little bit about growing up and then being in Lebanon? And
yes,
before
and
you
the
came?
War there and everything.
Yeah.
Sure. I was born to, my mother's side and my father's side are both Palestinian. We traced our ancestry via the United Nations Genealogy Center, and it turns out that both my sides of the family go back at least 500 years in Palestine. So we're pure Palestinian. My father's side is Schieber. When we came to America, we took Schieber because everybody would call me Schieber. Nobody would call me Schieber. I mean, it's like they would think I was Jewish German. My mother's side is Tannous, T-A-N-N-O-U-S. And both my grandfathers, George, it's a tradition in the Arab world where you inherit your grandfather's name. Like, for example, my son is Saba, and my father's name is Saba. Azza Tannous, my grandfather, and George Schieber, both were educated at Cambridge and Oxford, respectively. And they were both the first Arabs to get one MD from Oxford. That's Azza Tannous, my grandfather. He was the first Arab to get an MD from Oxford University, first Palestinian, too. That is entailed. And my grandfather from my father's side, George Schieber, was the first Arab to get a PhD, not an MD, a PhD from Cambridge University, which is the other big, you know, at the time. Remember, we're talking about the 1910, 1915. So that was the Harvard and the Yale and the Princeton of universities around the world.
Exactly.
And then he was, so let's concentrate a little bit about my grandfather, Azad, because he knew the Hussein family very well, and he was very good friends with Hajj Amin. He was born in Nablus in 1986. He was a medical doctor by training, but turned a politician when the Jewish, immigration from Europe started getting denser and denser.
Right.
And so there was a problem, but he was very good friends with Orthodox Jews. He was a pediatrician, and in fact, as a matter of fact, he delivered so many Orthodox Jewish babies. He was one of the very few pediatricians in Palestine in 1920, 1915, 1917, 1922. You know, the time era I'm talking about, right?
Right.
And then when problems arose, he became the representative of the Palestine Arab Higher Committee at the United Nations General Assembly during the British Mandate. Politically, he was pro-Majlis-i-Yun. The Majlis-i-Yun was an Arab political party. headed by the Hussein family, Haj Amin, and so on and so forth. And they believed in, they were parliamentarians, and they believed in coexistence. They believed in that Palestine should not be a state. Palestine belongs to all three religions. That is the philosophy of the Majlisiyun. Then he became the head of the Arab office in London during the Great Revolt. If you remember, of course you don't remember, we're not that old.
Not that old.
Right. But it's a way of saying, right?
I know.
he became the head of the Arab-Palestinian office in London during the Great Revolt of 1936. If you remember, violence erupted in Palestine in April of 1936. In that month, six prominent Arab leaders, including my grandfather, he was very rich. Actually, both grandfathers were involved in that revolt, overcame their rivalries and joined forces to protest Zionist advances in Palestine. The Arab High Command, which was led by Haj Amin, represented Arab interests in Palestine, and he sent my grandfather, when he quit medicine, he sent him to London, and later my grandfather would come to America and become the head of the Arab Refugee Office in Washington, D.C. And let me tell you, Ruthann, he would meet with John Foster Dulles. I don't know if you know, but of course you know John Foster Dulles. Under Eisenhower, he was the Secretary of State.
Yes. Yeah.
And everybody used to say that Eisenhower was great as a general, and we owe him all some debt in history. But he was a very weak president, and John Foster Dulles was such an overpowering political force that the saying was, he was the president. Everybody would say it around corners. He was the president. He would meet with John Foster Dulles weekly for 2 years, my Azab Tannous, my maternal grandfather. He quit medicine completely. He actually convinced John Foster Dulles to go in 1950, I'm counting John Foster Dulles and my grandfather, around the 50s, when was John Foster Dulles, he told them, come with me on a tour of the Middle East, I want you to check all the Palestinian refugee camps.
Wow.
And he agreed, it was under Eisenhower's approval that my grandfather and John Foster Dulles and a delegation would go to a tour of all the Palestinian refugee camps around the Arab world. Remember, not only in Palestine and Jordan and Syria, there were in Lebanon, there were also in Northern Africa. People don't realize in obviously Egypt, people don't think of Egypt as Northern Africa, but Egypt and Tunisia and Algeria and even Libya. The Palestinians were scattered all around, and after the tour, John Foster Dulles looked at my grandfather, who was Christian, by the way. By the way, we were born, both sides of my families are Christian, but that's not relevant. So what happened is he told him, and this is a semi-quote, the coffers of the United States government are open to you, the treasury. Are open to you. The Palestinians can take any sum of money they wish, and the United States government will help them land and establish a nation, a state, anywhere they want in the world. Just pick a location. My grandfather, in his book, The Palestinians, an Eyewitness Account, it's quoted there. He replied by saying, we do not sell our land for 30 pieces of silver. Just that's why I mentioned that he was Christian, you know.
Wow.
But on the other, he did you know that he, during the Arab Revolt of 1936, he came face to face with members of the Haganah, the Stern, Irgun, Zvi, Lemi, and these were like all Jewish terror groups. Of course, there was terrorism on both sides, but the British would arm the Jewish immigrants and would disarm the Palestinians. So there was an asymmetry in power, and that's why the ratio of death rate was 1 to 10. A Palestinian would die, 10 Palestinians would die for every Jew from 1936 till 1948. You believe that ratio, 1 to 10? Yep. But that's not surprising, right?
No, no.
Because the British would literally, the British were pulling out. It was World War II. They were finished. I mean, literally with India, and they every weapon they had in India, they gave it to Jews going to Palestine. And they would take every weapon that the Palestinians owned. Because remember, Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. And a lot of Palestinians, my grandfather himself, served as a medical captain in the Ottoman army in World War I. You believe it? He used to ride horseback.
Ah.
Yeah, he used to... In the book, I'm going to send that book to Sarit Jacobson in Nashville. And I hope, because I don't have a smartphone, I would take pictures from that book and post it on Facebook. From World War I, pictures that would make your heart bleed. For example, the famine in Lebanon. My grandfather went to teach medical school at the American University of Beirut. He would have to walk over dead bodies, the famine of Lebanon the famine, was it 1921 or something like that, when he was teaching there? But anyway, the other grandfather I had is George Schiber. He is the architect and the town planner of Talbiyeh. Which, I know, you know Talbiyeh, Ruthann?
I don't.
Okay, Talbiyeh is called the Beverly Hills of Jerusalem.
Ah, okay.
All the rich Arabs and rich Jews, before 1948,
right,
lived there. It was built, Talbiyeh in Arabic is a Talbiyeh. In Hebrew, it's called, I don't know it in Hebrew itself, because I don't speak Hebrew, but it's Kome Miyut. I got to look up what it means. It must mean something. It's an upscale neighborhood in Jerusalem, frequently referred to as the Beverly Hills of Jerusalem. Notable people who live there, by the way, some of them are dead, but Edward Said had a house there. We had a house there on both sides. Not me personally. I wasn't born, obviously.
No.
But my grandfather on my father's side and my grandfather on my mother's side had houses there. Shimon Peres, Begin, Rabin, Omar Barghouti has a house there now.
Okay.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, names that are definitely familiar, yes.
Very familiar. I mean, Edward Said is called the Palestine's greatest intellectual, although, you know, technically he was in comparative literature. He wasn't... But still, he's considered the Palestine's greatest intellectual. His book, The Question of Palestine, which influenced me a lot in the 1980s, is very, very influential. It's the first book on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to demand, as a matter of necessity, a one-state solution. This book was written, Ruthann, let me remember, 1981. Look how ahead of its time it was. Who would have thought in 1981 that the only solution would be a one-state solution?
Exactly.
Which brings me to this. It's as if the irrelevance of the Israeli talks, Israeli-Palestinian talks, they are so irrelevant. Obama and Netanyahu and everybody are trying to persuade Abbas, who's going to the UN and threatening with the suit and with the international... This is all, all an act. I'll get to that in a minute. It's all because of the midterm elections. They are too invested, and they want the Palestinians and, in a general sense, the Arabs on their side. They don't want to see a failure in the Israeli-Palestinian talks. Why? Because they want the Arabs on their side when it, I'm talking about America and Israel, because when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, Iran, Ukraine, South Korea, Syria, they have too much at stake. I mentioned the midterm elections. They have too much at stake to keep Abbas on the table. And if Abbas was really serious, he would go for an embargo.
Oh, I don't think anybody really who's aware really thinks that he's serious.
No, he's, in fact, the right word to describe him, I'm going to describe him. You know, remember, I was going to talk about the Palestinian Authority, I'm telling you, is part and parcel of Israeli occupation and Israel's system of apartheid. They are what used to be called the Bantustans. Is that a familiar word, Bantustans, in South Africa?
Yes, yes.
It was the native colonial authority, often compared to the Bantustans, the so-called black homelands in apartheid South Africa. Let me come to where, why, you know, Omar Barghouti. Do you know Omar Barghouti and Peter Beinart?
Yes, I've seen that videos.
Right, Omar Barghouti is the he wrote a book called Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights.
Yes.
On Haymarket Books. And in it, he was a student, by the way, at Columbia University when I was there at the same time, and we were friends. He formed the Arab Club of Columbia University, and I formed the Palestinian Solidarity Club of Columbia University. Being an Ivy League school, it had high profile. So we would invite a lot of Jews, a lot of Arabs to talk, and some would be Palestinian, some would be Egyptian, some would be Syrian, some would be Lebanese. A lot of Lebanese would come and talk. So Omar Barghouti is a friend, and during the boycott of South Africa, which Edward Said, God rest his soul, Edward Said was very part of the demonstrations at Columbia. We used to close departments, like with chains, and no professor or student could get in or get out, and we would chant, you know, boycott South Africa, boycott and embargo, and every time somebody would say that, I would tell Omar Barghouti, we're the same age, he's a year younger. He's doing his PhD in philosophy, by the way. He's an engineer by training from the 1980s. But now, as I'm talking to you right now, I told him, one day, you're too smart, one day you're going to get your PhD in philosophy. Guess where he's doing it? At Tel Aviv University, which is ironic because he's the leader of the boycott, divest, sanction. I told Omar once, in 1989, before he graduated, I told Omar, the only solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem is to do what we're doing now, is to boycott and divest and sanction Israel. Now, it's not going to work. We need a complete embargo. Why it's not going to work? Why? Look at the differences between South Africa and Israel. There are obvious similarities. Israel is a highly capitalistic country, ultra-militaristic, and that's a toxic mix of three things. And it's based on a racist apartheid system. The differences are the apartheid racism is not based, in the case of South Africa, on any theocratic religious basis. That's the difference. The difference is that there is the chosen people notion, which any Israeli who's born and raised in Israel from their infancy on and goes to the draft is brainwashed to believe that this is a promised land, they are the chosen people, plus their theocracy undergrits their apartheid racism. The other difference is that Israel has the only Federal Reserve Bank that has an office in America's Federal Reserve building. Think about that.
I did not know that, George.
It is the only country in the world. Think about it. Not Germany, not Spain, not Italy, not France, not Russia, for God's sake. Imagine that, right? That would be funny. But I'm telling you, Israel is, and what's Greenspan came in 1987. We used to chant, boycott South Africa, Israel next. Boycott South Africa, Israel next. That was in the 1980s when Omar Barghouti was doing an engineering degree and I was doing a math and philosophy degrees. And who did they put as chairman of the Fed? The chairman of the Fed. They put Greenspan, a Jew whose job was to make sure any country that boycotts, much less embargoes, Israel gets suffocated. Israel's central bank has an office in the Federal Reserve. And think about it. I'm going to ask you, Ruthann, with all honesty, and I'm trying to be as fair as possible here. I've been in America more than I've lived anywhere else in the world.
Right.
So I feel more American than anything else. We know Greenspan was Jewish. We know Bernanke was Jewish. We know Janet Yellen, is Jewish. And we know that Stanley Fischer, who's the vice person, was the former central bank head of the Israeli bank in 2005, right? Now, is it a coincidence that when BDS is picking up, and there are effects in Israel, there are effects on Israel so far, not much to bother Bibi. I'll tell you how Netanyahu is going to circumvent this BDS threat. But is it a coincidence that Stanley Fischer and Janet Yellen, both ultra-Zionists, get named both chair and vice chair of the Federal Reserve just when the BDS is picking up? That's not a coincidence. I'm sorry, Obama, I love you, I voted for you, but this was too obvious. It was too obvious. Especially Stanley Fischer. I mean, Stanley Fischer already had connections when he was a student of Greenspan. He was a co-student with Bernanke of Greenspan. Greenspan was the godfather. AIPAC controlled the Federal Reserve of America since 19... Guess since when?
Oh, my goodness.
39.
Okay. Yeah, I believe
that. The immediate precursor to today's pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC, we know, began in 1939 under the leadership of Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver from Lithuania. He created AZEC, the American Zionist Emergency Council. Like there wasn't an emergency in 1939. I understand emergency in the 40s. Of course, the Holocaust, of course, I'm not going to even touch that. Everybody respects, knows what happened and what horrific events happened. But in 1939, he created AZEC with the word emergency. He made Americans, he raised at the time when, look at this. In addition, he raised $2 million at a time, Ruthann, when a nickel, bought a loaf of bread. Think about that. $2 million at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. But let's not go there. I mean, that gets too much.
So that's a lot of money now, I mean, for me. But that was an enormous sum then, for sure.
Enormous sum then. I mean, we're talking about 1939. That would be like raising, $4 billion today or something like that? Let me do the math, and I'll get back to you. I'll let my wife
do
the math.
You're the mathematician, George.
I know, right? look how Netanyahu is going to do it. Look what Netanyahu is going to do. He knows that Omar Barghouti, who's behind the boycott, divest, sanction, is going to graduate with a degree in philosophy, specializing in moral and political philosophy. So he's going to be one heck of an argumentator, of an arguer.
Yes.
He's going to enter politics. He's going to run. If Marwan Barghouti is not in the running, Omar Barghouti, not related, is going to win. Now, look what is going to happen. Netanyahu knows that Omar Barghouti is a year away from graduating and entering the political arena. That's very dangerous. Second, what is going to happen is that Netanyahu is going to allow Dahlan. Dahlan is a mafia running type of organizational guy who was the second, the right hand side of Yasser Arafat when Yasser Arafat was so to speak imprisoned in his house by the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
Dahlan was the guy who took over. He's the guy under Israeli orders that poisoned Arafat, and it's out in the open right now. It's not even a secret. And Dahlan killed the head of Hamas. I forgot his name. The head of Hamas at the time in because he's now in Qatar. Okay, he killed the head of Hamas. His name is Salah Shahadeh. Salah Shahadeh is as popular in Gaza as Elvis Presley is in Nashville. No, where is Elvis Presley from?
He spent his life in Nashville. Yeah,
he's that popular. He's the one who killed Arafat and Salah Shahadi. What's Netanyahu going to do? The question right now, why all of a sudden the question of should Israel allow Mohammed Dahlan to re-enter to enter Palestine / Israel when Abbas is negotiating? And Abbas, at the same time, I told you, he's part and parcel of the apartheid Israeli system. Yes. Why would Abbas not go and ask for the International Criminal Court to imagine if you can sue Boeing, Lockheed Martin, you can sue the Department of Defense if Abbas wanted to. That would strengthen the BDS so much. But no, he's agreeing for Dahlan to come in. Abbas knows he's too old. Why he's agreeing with Israel, with Netanyahu? Because Marwan Barghouti, part of the deal for Abbas to continue the peace talks with America, not Israel, with America, is, and obviously by extension Israel, but with America, the way he phrased it, is that Marwan Barghouti, who's a hero in Palestine, a hero, gets released. What would happen if Dahlan and Marwan Barghouti are coexisting in Israel? A Palestinian civil war, which is impossible. Wait a minute. I said impossible, but I'm telling you, Netanyahu and I met at MIT at a Chomsky lecture. Netanyahu told me, yeah, Edward Said was there, and he was a youngster. I mean, we're the same age, by the way. He's a little older. He's a youngster. Edward Said and Chomsky were elder intellectuals. They were geniuses, and in their fields. Netanyahu told Chomsky, what are the chances of one day there will be a Palestinian civil war? Chomsky said never. Edward Said said never. I said never. And I'll tell you a little sentence here. In the whole wars from 1936, when the revolt started, 48, 82 war with the PLO and Israel, up till today, a Palestinian never fought in a war, whether civil, whether guerrilla, with another Palestinian.
Right.
That's what Netanyahu is planning to counter the BDS. He's going to allow Dahlan in. Dahlan is a staunch enemy of Marwan Barghouti. And that's what, look at the traitor Abbas. He's going to allow it. He asked for the release of Marwan Barghouti, and he's going to allow the re-entry of Dahlan. I know Abbas thinks he's too old. He's not too old. 80 is not old in America, but it's old in the Middle East, right?
Yeah.
He wants to create a civil war when Dahlan and Marwan Barghouti are both in the open. This is what I'm scared of the most, but imagine you sue Lockheed Martin, the Department of Defense, Boeing, you know, you sue all these companies that Israel is the head of in a corporation. But it makes me sick that they put Stanley Fisher. He gave a lecture. He gave a talk when he became vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, Stanley Fisher, of America, of the American Federal Reserve. He was the head of the Israeli Central Bank. He gave a speech at University of California, San Diego, and he said, under me and Janet Yellen, no country will dare, that's the word, dare, and I will link you the talk, I will link you the PDF actually, no country will dare embargo, that's the danger, the embargo. Israel is not worried about BDS, this is like a nuisance. The right word is nuisance. Sanction and boycott. It's a nuisance. It's not going to. It's not an existential threat to the existence of Israel, but a complete embargo. That's what he used the word. Stanley Fisher used the word embargo, which shows you where it's going. And if Abbas was not, as I said, part and parcel of the Israeli establishment, he would go sue in the International Criminal Court, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, the Department of Defense, America, and would sue Sharon, who's the mastermind behind Sabra and Shatila, which is the reason we left the Middle East, by the way. My mother couldn't take anymore her children living in the Middle East after the two massacres, Sabra and Shatila. And then we ended up in America. I mean, I was lucky to have had a father who came to America and took his PhD in America. And he actually, that's another little factoid. He was the youngest Palestinian to get a PhD from Harvard University. Youngest. So my grandfathers were the first Palestinians to get PhDs and MDs from Cambridge and Oxford. And my father was the youngest Palestinian, youngest. Now we're talking age. Youngest to get a degree from Harvard. But then he went to MIT. He got a degree. He got his PhD in another PhD in urban design. His first PhD was in architecture, and he double majored. Doesn't matter. So I was lucky that he stayed long enough in America, taught at American universities. He taught at Cornell, at MIT, and he taught at New York University. He became citizen. So when my mother wanted to leave the Middle East, it was very easy. All she had to do was go to the American embassy and say, look, my children were born to an American, technically speaking.
Right.
Because my father had the citizenship, and we were on a ship to Cyprus. It was that easy. After Sabra and Shatila, you know, we couldn't take it anymore. I mean, not me. I didn't want to come to America. I was so anti-American. I was so anti-capitalist. I was so such a Marxist. I was like, Mom, take me to the Soviet Union. I don't want to come to America. They have universities in the Soviet Union. I got a PhD in mathematics. They have, you know, as good mathematicians as they have in America. That was a joke. And my mother, of course, would have none of that. And that was the funniest fight I had. I had to be kidnapped. My mother had to kidnap me to bring me to America. I grew a beard because the only way out of Lebanon at the time was through checkpoints controlled by the Christian Phalange and the Israeli army. And if you had a beard, that meant you were a Muslim terrorist, you know the deal. And I grew a beard, and I grew my hair very messy, and I was 19 or something like that. And I no way I wanted to come to America. America was the biggest enemy in my mind at all. I had read, Marx since the age of 9. I was so much a Marxist. I said, if I come to America, I'll die. And it changed my life, of course. Not that I'm not a Marxist anymore. Not that Marx didn't make mistakes. Not that Marxism is correct economically. But I'm still a neo-Marxist. You can be corrected. You can, you know what I mean here. But so that's the story. I mean, with Marx, I was always interested in him. When I was very young, I was interested in mathematics, but Marx especially, his concept of reproduction, economic reproduction, was very interesting. His theory of exploitation and surplus value was very interesting to me, but very problematic. Well, we all know that economists found a lot of problems with that. But his critique of capitalist exploitation was very appealing to me. Because Lebanon was very capitalistic, and I hated it. I hated capitalism.
I did not realize that Lebanon was.
Lebanon. Yeah, sorry.
George, no, I wanted to ask you, because Abbas is, we know what he is. But it seems that it's easy for him to do what he's doing and not really make any headway, you know, because they're trying, they being Israel, United States and all, they have deemed Hamas a terrorist organization kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, even though the leaders, Hamas was elected, the people in there,
absolutely,
by a completely
democratic means.
It was an accredited thing. It was there was not voter fraud like there were so many places. I mean, the people wanted Hamas. And so, you know, just because the United States and Israel doesn't like them, then they brand them as terrorists.
I absolutely agree. But look what's happening in general in the Middle East. Israel has a plan. I mean, it's amazing. Israel does nothing by accident.
No.
And America is too huge a country to not make mistakes. Israel plans everything so... I mean, I cannot tell you how much detail they go into every decision they do. Israel has always been... The main idea of Israel is to Islamicize and radicalize Muslims. Radicalize and fundamentalize them,
right.
And to make for two reasons. First, it's divide and conquer.
Right.
You have the Sunni versus the Shia, the Alawites versus the this, and you get the idea. The second part is that the more fundamental and radical Islam becomes, and that's the key here, the more subjugated women become, and women are the key in every revolution that had emancipation written on it, whether it's human rights, civil rights, whether it's this right or that right, whether it's this country or that country. Women were always a big part of it.
Right.
And they want women to be quiet. They want them to be subjugated. They want, and that's part of making certain groups like the Brotherhood in Egypt, Hamas in Palestine, Hezbollah by America, a terrorist organization. You know, soon they're going to declare the UN a terrorist organization, you know?
Right. So, our friend Sarit has told us how the women in Israel are totally second-class citizens.
Yes, absolutely. Well, depends on where you live. Depends where you live. In Tel Aviv, for example, Tel Aviv seems to be oblivious to what's happening. Let me ask you a question. A country that is supposedly, I know we know it's a theocracy, but supposedly it's a democracy, that's committing such crimes against humanity, according to international lawyers and lawyers without borders, according to the International Criminal Court, they're committing crimes against humanity. On both sides, I'm faulting also Palestinians. I'm a Palestinian, so I'm not only faulting Israeli, the average citizen. Where are the massive protests on the streets? I mean, during the war in Lebanon, more Israelis went to the streets of Tel Aviv protesting the war. But of course, we know why. Because Israeli blood was being shed. The PLO was killing Israeli soldiers. It's not because they cared about Palestinians dying under PLO umbrella.
Right.
But why not now? The massive demonstrations for civil rights on both sides, because Sarit is right. Women are subjugated in Israel. The Palestinians in general are. So that tells me one thing. There is an inherent racism at the general level, not just pockets of racism. And that's how apartheid works. It brainwashes you from way... I mean, I mentioned that point early on. Peter Beinart, who's he used to be the former editor of the New York Republic. He has written for Time, the New York Times, the New York Review of Books. He's at the Graduate Center where I am. I am almost there weekly. I talk to him. He wants to create. He's a Jew himself, American Jew himself. He was born in 1971. He wants to create what is called Zionist BDS. He wants to join forces when Omar Barghouti graduates and gets into politics. He told me, I mentioned the differences between South Africa and Israel and why boycotts, divest, sanctions won't work. There is a theocratic underpinning for the apartheid racism. You don't have that. You didn't have that in South Africa. You have a religious chosen people thesis. You didn't have that in South Africa. The Dutch were not chosen people by anybody. I didn't read that anywhere. You had a promised land thesis. I didn't hear in any biblical work or any book of religion that said the Dutch were promised South Africa. So Beinart agreed with those points, and said for that reason it's not going to work. The only thing that works is an embargo, and boom, look what Netanyahu is going to do. He's going to re-enter Dahlan, release Marwan, civil war, and he puts Stanley Fischer and Janet Yellen Federal Reserve, guaranteeing that no country can do anything. Any country, Spain, for example, if Spain considers an embargo on Israel right now, Stanley Fisher and Janet Yellen have the power to put them in Chapter 11. Literally, the whole country will go bankrupt. No country can, and countries know it. Countries know it. They're gonna scare everybody. So Netanyahu is a micro political genius. He has no macro visionary insights at all. He's a moron when it comes to visionary politics, but he's a micro political tactician. Okay. And that's what he's gonna do. Two things: civil war between Marwan Barghouti and Dahlan, and he put Janet Yellen and Stanley Fisher. Who do you think named them? It was under the recommendation of Netanyahu. Obama had no word. Obama had no influence over Stanley Fisher. He's Israeli. Israeli. Okay, so I gave him the American citizenship, but he's Israeli. Why? Do you know how many qualified economists we have in this country?
Yeah. I would think that there is quite a few. Yeah.
I personally know so much, and I'm one person. Imagine how much there is out there. And, but I got interested in, we digress a lot into politics, I suppose, but...
that's fine. No, that's...
Thank you so much. You're so kind. By the way, I'm a big fan of your show, and I will tune in every time. I was interested in mathematics very early on. I had a very good mathematics teacher, and he had his PhD from MIT in mathematics, and he used to teach... He found out that I was interested in prime numbers. Prime numbers, Euclid showed, are like the building blocks of all numbers. So it's like quarks for numbers. And I became interested in Riemann's hypothesis. Basically, it's a hypothesis relating this Riemann's zeta function to the distribution of prime numbers. And once he saw me interested in that, he introduced me to another hypothesis called the Poincaré hypothesis, or conjecture, which has been proven. Riemann's hypothesis, which says basically that the function, the sum of n equals 1 to infinity of 1 over n to the power s, the function that takes s and gives us that function, is equal to the product of all primes, of all prime numbers, 1 over 1 minus prime p prime to the power minus s. So that's Euler's theorem. What the conjecture is that they are equal, that they are equal functions. That has not been, if you prove Riemann's conjecture, you win the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in mathematics. The Poincaré conjecture is interesting. Not that Riemann is not interesting. It says that the sphere is the simplest topological form in three dimensions. Now, my math teacher asked me, what's your intuition? What's your guess? If you generalize from three dimension to four dimension, to five dimension, to six dimension, and ask the same question, what is the simplest topological shape or form or, you know, structure in n dimensions? Then I told him, why stop at a finite amount of dimensions, because I was interested in infinities as well. I said, why don't you consider an infinitely dimensional space and ask that question? And he was taken aback because he wasn't into infinities at all. And, I mean, we all know real numbers have infinite expansions after the decimal point. But the point of real numbers is that they measure to infinite precision finite objects. What infinite objects, like large cardinals, they measure to exact precision infinite objects. So that's the difference. So although real numbers have expansions that never stop, so they go to infinity after the decimal point, they only measure, though, to infinite precision, only finite objects. So I told them, look, in infinite dimension, depending on the cardinality, because there are infinitely many infinities, and not only that, there are more than that even. Not only infinitely many infinities, there are more than that. And I proved the theorem that says in cardinality greater than aleph Aleph 1, in cardinality greater than Aleph 1, an Aleph 1 dimensional space, does not have a unique, simplest topological form, structure. And I was like 11, and that's when the Civil War started, and that's when the war started affecting my education, and I started like going in and out of school because of the war. Schools would close, no electricity, no buses. You can imagine the war, you know, on the effect the war has.
Yeah. Well, you said you were 11.
At that time, yeah, when I was working, that's when the war started. I was 11.
Okay, wow.
The war started, you know how? By a school bus shooting. It was horrible. Then I was working with Marxism, Nash Equilibrium, Arrow's Theorem, Sen. I was working on the relationship between equality and justice and Nash Equilibrium. And I could easily show that, you know, I was under the tutelage of a great, great mathematician. So he would come to the house almost weekly and tutor me in college level and graduate level math. So he was, you know, we're still in touch and everything like that. The point is, he introduced me to Nash Equilibrium, and I was aware of Arrow and Sen and stuff like that. So I showed there are relationships between equality and justice and Nash Equilibrium between cooperation and competition. If you allow educational institutions to compete optimally, then you guarantee and tax the rich and tax the rich, you guarantee that you escape Arrow's theorem, which says that in a democracy you always have a dictator. A dictator is defined as somebody such that no matter how much information you have about the market and your situation, no matter what you decide to do, that dictator can always make a decision that is optimally better than yours, no matter what you do. That's the definition of dictator. If I showed that you can have Rawlsian notion of justice, if and only if Nash equilibrium, there is Nash equilibrium between cooperation and competition and taxing the rich, as well as allowing educational institutions to compete optimally, you avoid Arrow's impossibility theorem. It's called Kenneth Arrow at Harvard University. So that's a very famous theorem, very famous theorem. It stands in the way of a lot of work on economics in the neoliberal and democratic traditions, because nobody wants a dictator, you know, in their society. In fact, you can prove that Arrow's theorem entails that there are infinitely many dictators in a society in which there are infinitely many citizens. So that is a problem. I mean, also you can show a lot of things. Nash equilibrium between cooperation and competition on the open market is bioevolutionary sense selected for, and it is in this selection also avoids Kenneth Arrow from Harvard University. Kenneth Arrow's dictatorship theorem, impossibility theorem, is called. Also, this bioevolutionary selection of Nash equilibrium between cooperation and competition in the open market maximizes the value of the middle class agency, defined as in a Bayesian utilitarian sense as a Bayesian agent is somebody who is in some a priori sense interested in their own interests and values, and does not do anything that is morally unhinges on anybody else's right, consistent with their own right to do the same. So you can talk a lot about that. That affected my critique of Marx, because Marxism seems to come. Marxism entails that Nash equilibrium between cooperation. Everybody wants cooperation in society, obviously, and competition in the open market. We need Nash equilibrium. Marxism entails that this is impossible. There is no Nash equilibrium. Of course, Marx didn't know anything about Nash. Marx lived way, way before.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about Marxist economists.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became interested in Hilbert's program, and I came across Gödel's theorem, which shows that no theory can prove its own consistency. Since truth entails consistency, no theory can prove that it is true. And that made me interested in philosophy of science, philosophy of mathematics. So I wanted to study philosophy of mathematics so much. I came to America, and I did a semester at Harvard, and then I transferred to Columbia because the best two mathematicians alive were at Columbia University, and the best philosopher of mathematics, Charles Parsons, who wrote me the best letter of recommendation I can imagine. They were all at Columbia University, and I got a letter from Edward Said, who's my mother's cousin, to come to Columbia University, and I was homesick. My mother, my brother, my sister, they were all at in Manhattan. And Manhattan is beautiful. Columbia University is just another Ivy League. It's not – Harvard is maybe a tiny little bit better, but not in every department. It depends on what. So I came to Columbia, and I don't regret it at all. It's a beautiful campus in the middle of an urban jungle. You have this beautiful, beautiful European-type, castle-type campus. And what I like about it the most is that one of the seventh largest, Columbia has the seventh largest library in the world. Number one being the Congress, number two being New York Public Library, number three being Harvard, number four being Yale, number five being Princeton, number six being Cornell, number seven being Columbia. These are the biggest libraries in the world. And it's a huge structure with columns. They are overwhelming when you walk in front of it. And I like the fact that the top, all the names of the philosophers are on top. No other name from any other field is there. Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Hume, Democritus, Epicurus, Heraclitus. You don't find Einstein. You don't find Madame Curie. You don't find... I always like that fact, you know, but that's a digression.
Oh, that's interesting, though. But now, wasn't it... One of the draws for Columbia was that your mother was nearby, too?
Nearby, and absolutely, absolutely. The cooking, I miss the cooking, and which I don't regret. I mean, I met my wife in New York, so
yeah.
you can't regret that. Harvard, the campus, I didn't like the campus too much. I was very homesick. Remember, I was also, I didn't even want to come to America.
In the first place, right.
In the first place. So to be without my mother on top of it and my sister and my brother, I mean, I shared the same room. I mean, we lived in war. I mean, it's not like we lived in a villa.
Right.
So I shared the same bedroom with my brother all my life until we came to America. Even in America, we had a one-bedroom apartment, which is like now $5,000 a month. Imagine now. I'm talking now. I'm talking about in the 80s. I miss my brother. I miss everybody, the food, plus Edward Said. I wanted to be around Edward Said. And look at the luck. Edward Said's office was under our department. The Department of Comparative Literature was housed under the philosophy department, in the Department of Philosophy. So I would see him every morning. We would talk politics every time. I see him. Chomsky would visit Columbia University once a month because he was very good friends with Edward Said. And every time he would visit Columbia, I would get together with Chomsky and Said and my advisor, Sidney Morgenbesser, who was a rabbi before he became a professor of philosophy and got his PhD in philosophy. So wonderful discussions. I will never forget those years, you know?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you were really blessed.
I got very lucky. Yeah. I got very lucky. I got lucky with scholarships and grants and funding. I'm talking throughout my whole graduate schools too, not just undergrad. And I never had to – I mean, I really have to thank God a million times if I weren't, you know – well, you get the idea. But I got lucky. My brother got lucky. My sister got lucky. We always qualified for scholarships and grants and funds.
Well, that's it. I mean, you got lucky in a sense, but you were fortunate. But it wasn't like it was given to you.
It wasn't. Especially you. Thank you for asking that. Because at the graduate level, we earned it with showing the grades. I mean, my sister, for example, my sister graduated number one in a class of 320 people at Columbia University. It's one of the best colleges and universities in the world. She came number one. When I graduated from the math department, I was number four out of like 200 people. And of course, the first three were Russians. They're as good in math as they are in chess, Russia. Not anymore. I'm talking about the Cold War. The Cold War was so, it's so different. But, so, you know, then I got interested in metaphysics. I wanted to know what it is to be an object in the logical sense.
Right.
And that's when I wanted to go back to Harvard, because Quine, Willard Van Orman Quine, was the main logician who worked on ontology, and that's one of the main branches in metaphysics, ontology.
You know what? We're going to have you back to talk about metaphysics, George, because...
Yes, because we dominated with politics.
Sorry. No, don't be sorry a bit. You're so interesting. I thought I heard a little one in the background. I know you have a couple. But we'll just have you back. And
I'll come back for metaphysics if you want.
Right, come back for metaphysics. Now, you are on Blog Talk Radio. George, we can say either Cyber or...
Schreiber in America. I go by Schreiber.
Yeah. And George Schreiber lectures. And when is your next one?
Sunday. I'm going to talk about Chrysippus puzzle of identity. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to talk about three-dimensionalism versus four-dimensionalism in philosophy of physics.
Okay.
That would be Sunday, and I would post it Sunday and Wednesday. Thank you so much for mentioning that.
Yeah, no, please. I do you know what time yet?
6 o'clock on Sunday.
Okay.
And 12 o'clock p.m. They're both p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 12 o'clock on Wednesday.
Okay. 6 o'clock p.m. on Sunday and 12 o'clock
on Wednesday,
which is like noon on Wednesday. Right. And as soon as you get it posted up, I'll put it out too. So.
Thank you so much.
George,
have me back for metaphysics.
Right.
And I really enjoyed talking to you. You're so kind. You're so graceful.
I always
I'm a big fan of yours. Big, big fan of yours.
I always enjoy talking to you. So we will end. You're going to be part of our special in May about the Mavi Mamara. So,
yes. Absolutely.
So we will see you, well, before then. But thank you again.
Thank you.
You have a great Easter, too. A nice holiday weekend. And
you, too. And it's
been
a pleasure.
The kids and all that, you know. Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure and an honor having been on your show, Ruthann.
Thank you so much, George.
You're welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're back, and we have with us Rusty Nugent. Hello? Rusty. Hello.
Hey. Hey. Can you hear me?
No. Yes, definitely.
Okay. I was having problems getting the thing to answer.
Oh, well, no, because I had put you had put it on mute, and I was trying to talk to you. And anyway, so we have you live. And, oh, happy belated birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, you had a birthday a couple days ago. So
yep.
I remember, yeah. And tonight we're going to talk about, oh, my goodness, all the, well, from werewolves to vampires to the actual art of writing, because you have been researching and studying this topic for a long time. Do you want to just start out and tell us how you first got involved in writing to begin with?
Well, it just kind of happened. I just kind of got started in it when I was a kid. I had this favorite movie called The Car, which was about a demonic automobile, and I'd already liked the movie Jaws, and it just kind of influenced me. Jaws influenced me to write this. I was like, well, I don't see a book for it, so me being 6 or 7, I just picked up some markers and did my own version of it, of the movie, and it was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 pages. But it kind of started me on the path of writing, and I just kind of kept going ever since.
I think it's, man, that's funny, though, that got you going in the car when you were 6 or 7. Yeah. I do want to say that you can be found at Phantom, that's Phantum, Wolf, Wolf, dot Wix, Wix.com. / Rusty Nugent. And well, now that this was, you did The Car, and all that, where did you get into? First, I should ask, what is dark fantasy?
Well, dark fantasy is fantasy with elements of horror in it. Anything that's scary, tense, suspenseful, gory, anything like that.
Gory.
yeah. Or has elements of it in it. So I just kind of combined it all in mine. Or it has elements of horror, like what you would say, horror movie creatures in it, you know, like vampires, werewolves, or whatever. But with a dark twist to it.
So
that's pretty much what dark fantasy is, yes.
So like your book covers aren't going to be a beautiful, bright, light meadow full of flowers.
No.
No. That would not be dark at all. So
No, you're not going to see the unicorns and stuff like that on them, no.
Right. They'll be, like, literally darker, and maybe some of these creatures.
Well, yeah, on my first book right now, as it is, you'll see a really big, fat harvest moon on it with a werewolf snarling and a castle. And
okay.
That's it.
Castle.
Okay.
You've written 3 books, but your first one was Moon Warriors, and then you wrote Moon Warriors, Guardians of the Night.
Mm-hmm.
And now your third one is?
Moon Warriors and a Blackened Dawn.
That's in a Blackened Dawn, yes.
Yes.
So, now, do they have the basic same characters?
Yes, they do pretty much have the same basic main characters, yeah.
Okay, so, are there going to be more books with these characters, more Moon Warriors?
Well, it depends. Well, what happened was, with the third book, I'm going to bring this trilogy to a close, but I am going to write a fourth book entitled Children of the Night that's going to explain the origins of how they came to be, the vampires and werewolves. And there will be some characters that would be in the first book that's going to explain kind of how they got to where they were. So it's kind of like a circle. I guess it's kind of like a prequel, I guess you'd say.
Oh, okay. Well, that's really fun. I mean, those are fun to go back to the beginning and say, okay, so this is why or whatever these things happened, or this is where these people came from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when did you? Now you started writing then at 6 or 7, but when did you actually get into this really dark fantasy or horror story? Because
well,
you have written a horror book, yeah.
Well, I've been writing off and on all my life, like I said, but I was mostly dabbled in horror and different things like that, mostly horror. I didn't really even know what I was writing. I didn't even know there was a title for it. I was like, dark fantasy, what is that? You know?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I was writing it and didn't even know what it was. But like I said, I started writing Moon Warriors in 1996. I started researching it about the same time. So I was researching it and writing it as I went. And I had no idea that there was a thing as dark fantasy. So I was just thinking, this is just going to be a dark, medieval, you know, fairy tale, basically. And that was it. And it just kept going and going and going. And I didn't even get it published until 2003. And by the time it got published, you had Underworld coming out of the movie and all of this, and I was like, oh, they beat me to it. But it's still not my book as far as the spirit, because I don't concentrate on the negative aspect of what everybody's idea of what a werewolf is. In their movie, werewolves still eat people. In my book, if a werewolf eats a person, they're either evil or out of their minds. My werewolves are heroic. They don't do that. If they see a werewolf doing that, they kill them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a major difference.
They're protectors. Yeah, they're protectors. So it's a totally different thing. You know.
Well,
a totally different,
that's totally different than the mean protectors. It's a whole other thing. I wonder why that. Well, that's just you. I mean, you didn't want to concentrate on the dark, but yet you wanted something a little out of the ordinary, should we say?
I was kind of where I was getting a bad reputation. You know, they always have the, you know, he gets changed, he, you know, goes on a rampage, kills everybody, dies in the end, that's it. You know, and I was like, I'm tired of reading that or seeing that in movies. I'm going to do something different. And my girlfriend said, well, why don't you write a story for me? I was like, okay, so I did it, and I said, well, let's make him the hero in this. So that's what I did. And, a lot of people who are...
Your girlfriend?
Yeah, a lot of people who like werewolves are really like, oh, my goodness, finally something different, you know?
Yeah. Well, I can see that.
Yeah.
You've done extensive research, Rusty. I mean, I think that some people, for their thesis, probably don't do as much research as you have. You've really gone back. When was the first mention, either in something we have written or stories that were passed down? When have you found, like, the first werewolf actually mentioned a story?
The first written mention of werewolves is in 2000 BC in the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's the first literary evidence of werewolves, and that's in 2000 BC.
Okay. So it's 4,000 years ago.
So they go back that far.
What did they call them? Were they called werewolves or?
Well, before they were called werewolves, they were called the Cynocephali or dog-headed people. And they were actually found pretty much all over the world. But according to legend, they originated in the land of Canaan, which means canine. And that's, you know, ancient biblical text, you know. That goes back even further than that.
Right, so the dog-headed people, okay, the from Canaan, so they were in the Bible?
Yeah, they're mentioned in the Bible, sure is. Mm-hmm.
The dog-headed people. And what do you think that, like the ones in the Bible, what do you think they really look like, or what kind of actions did they exhibit?
Well, it's kind of like somebody, I read a quote, and I can't remember who said it, but somebody said, you know, if you think you're a monster, mm-hmm. you'll behave like
one. Okay.
You know, so I think it depends on the individual, you know. Talking about Canaan and stuff like that, bringing us to werewolves in the Bible, St. Christopher... We spoke of this a while back. His original name was Reprobus, which means reprobate or scoundrel. He was born in Canaan, but he was martyred in the city of Antioch in Asia Minor in circa 251 A.D.
Okay, in Antioch. How was he killed?
How was he hung? He was beheaded.
He was beheaded. Okay.
Yes.
And that is a typical. I mean, this is a good way to kill werewolf.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
I mean, I
that
guess
that
was...
fire or silver.
Okay. So. And he was killed. Well, then obviously people knew that he was one, a dog-headed person.
Yeah. They said he was terrifying to behold. He stood 7'5", and he was a bad person that you didn't, you know, he was a cannibal, apparently.
Well.
And so they said,
cannibal,
I don't know.
Yeah, being accountable, well, at least to me, doesn't make a person a bad person, because I think that, meat is meat. If you're going to be a meat eater, you know, why worry about where
yeah.
it comes from? So speak, you know, vegan here, because it's like, well, okay, it's all meat. But
yeah,
he was a scoundrel before he got religion, is that it? So, and of course he didn't become a saint till after he was dead, because you don't. But
yeah.
he must have done enough good works for the church to make him a saint. So I wonder why he was killed.
Well, yeah, he was basically beheaded because he wouldn't worship their gods, and they kept trying to bribe him. Yeah, they kept trying to bribe him, and he wouldn't accept it. So they got tired of it and tried to assassinate him a few times, and they failed, and they finally beheaded him.
Okay, that was it. Okay.
But I don't know if I'd want that job, because I don't know if I'd want to try to behead a 7'5" werewolf.
No, you know, that must have been one of those times when some kind of drug in the drink was used to...
It could have been.
Put him out. you know. I can't imagine somebody 7'5".
Yeah, he was 7.5 feet tall. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I've known a couple people like 6'5" or 6'6", and it's like, wow. So
yeah,
add another foot to that. Well, now would that be typical of the dog-headed people back then? The height?
No, they said he was actually a giant even among them.
Okay.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by that too.
Well, now, okay, this is just taking that to another place. Then, you know, in the Old Testament, it talks about the giants, who a lot of us, mm-hmm. Presume to, mm-hmm. people from other planets and universes, coming to mate with people on Earth. Do you think that possibly he would have been at least had some kind of a bloodline from elsewhere also?
Could have
because
been.
Because of his eyes?
Quite possibly.
Wow. It blew me away when you said that before, that St. Christopher was a werewolf. It's like, okay, then. That was just so strange. But,
I was shocked by it, too.
Well, you found a lot of strange things, though, haven't you, in all this research?
Yeah, I've been doing it for quite a few years to, I always try to add some facts and legendary facts or any kind of facts into my books to, add some depth to them and things like that. And sometimes, as they say, fact is stranger than fiction. And some of the facts I've been finding out is just like, wow.
Definitely stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
So. What are some other things? You already said that you find dog-headed people, werewolves, however you want to say, pretty much around the world.
Yes.
And through time.
Well, here's the thing I find interesting, okay? All around the world, throughout history, okay, you have people, cultures that never met up until a certain recent timeline that mm-hmm. know what these things are, be they vampire, werewolf, whatever. They may not call them the same name, but they know what they are. They have a name for it. How do they know that? You get what I'm saying?
Right.
Right,
but if they didn't have actual physical contact with them,
exactly.
Or their ancestors.
They've witnessed it, seen it, interacted with it, something. How do they know what it is if they've never seen it? They don't know these people, so how do they know?
Well, and
that's
they have
what
nothing.
I find interesting.
So they have to have been scattered around. That makes me think because sometimes we don't recognize something if we have nothing to compare it to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to have, but that makes sense. I mean, depending, because there's so many theories about how we came to be bioengineered on this planet anyway, and so it would make sense that there would be more than one species of human just mixes. Let me ask you, you've heard it all now because you're writing this, you're doing all kinds of research. So you've heard people talk about nowadays there being, well, I guess in throughout the ages, reptilian people. Do you, what kind of, you haven't? Heard
no,
that?
I've heard about, we're talking about aliens, ancient aliens and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I know somebody who is totally sane and says he met one who was actually very nice. He said, people shouldn't fear them. So how do you feel? Do you think that there are these beings here now?
The way that I look at it is, I keep an open mind, and I do believe that aliens are here. They've always been visiting us,
right?
And we've got a lot more visitations yet to come. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I believe that too. It only makes sense. But are you going to do some writing about far in the future? or I know you're going to write it, 2030 or something like that, 2035? Aren't you doing one of your...
Well, in my third book, the one I'm writing, it's in the future, but I don't specify what year. That way I can kind of get away with keeping it now but not now. It's on the verge of becoming further, but it's still contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. Because, you know, even in the 50s, they thought in 2000 we would be, you know, living on the moon, you know, which we're not.
Right.
We're almost, but we're not.
Right.
But, we're still driving cars on the road, you know.
Right. But we were to have some kind of hovercraft kind of thing.
Yeah.
A car that was, so, I mean, they had a lot of ideas that have come to fruition, but there were still a few things that, are not. Do you in your mind... I won't ask you the years, but do you have some years in your mind in the future where this, what you're writing now, like you said, you're not saying it's a certain year, but do you have something in your mind like, well, I'm writing for such and such a time?
I would say, if I had to hazard a guess, I would say that the second book takes place any time between now and like 20 to 35 years in the future, something like that.
Okay. The second book.
That way it's the third book.
Oh, the third, okay.
The second book takes place now.
Right, it's now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now, you did a lot of research for during the medieval time research.
Oh, yes.
So did you feel like you were pretty much practically living there? I mean, while you were... Where do you research? Do you research online? Do you go to... some wonderful library that's got certain books that you can't online, or how do you do your research, Rusty?
Well, for the first book, the internet didn't exist when I did the first book. It was a new thing. I didn't even have a computer. I had to go, luckily I had a mother who was a book freak like I was, and she said, you know, all through my childhood, she bought, just libraries of encyclopedias. So I went to the encyclopedias and looked up everything I needed, as much as I could. And then, of course, she also had books on weird stuff. I mean, you name it. My mom was a very interesting woman. You know, she might have been a Catholic, but she was into UFOs and Bigfoot. And, I mean, anything that tied into anything strange, she was into it, which is where I get it from. Mm-hmm. And
nothing
would
be a Catholic. I mean, that's not, no. But you sometimes people think that people in certain religions are so dogmatic they don't think outside the box.
Oh, my mom thought very outside the box, and so do I. But, I did a lot of my research thanks to her. I mean, she had so many books that I was able to leaf through and look and find all this stuff up. And then I had to go to other things when it came to stuff like, I mean, I had to research stuff like how did they, you know, make their weapons back then, and how did they live? And, you know, you have to know this stuff if you're going to write about your environment.
Yeah.
So I did it. And I thought, oh my God, am I ever going to get to write my book? Because all I'm doing is homework, you know?
Did you ever go watch a blacksmith or go to some kind of those reenactment things? What's that one major one, Penzac or something?
You're talking about a
big festival.
No, I didn't get to go to one of those. I never did. I didn't get to do that. But I did a lot of research about the lifestyle back then.
Yeah.
And I just wrote about it as much as I could and tried to put myself into that mindset. And the one thing that I didn't like, or I didn't want to fall into, because it's hard to read for some people, and it's kind of hard for me to understand too as a reader, because I didn't want to fall into the trap of trying to write the way they speak, because they're speaking ancient Moldavian, not English.
Thank
so they're not
you.
Going to speak
yeah.
like
yeah.
like thus thusly does he go and all that. They're not going to speak like that. They're speaking another language. So I tried to write it where anybody can understand it.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Some people kind of accuse me of being, you're a terrible writer. I'm like, no, you don't understand what I'm trying to do. You know, I tried to make a modern-day dark fairy tale about back then, and a lot of people don't get it. So I guess you either love it or you hate it, you know?
Well, I'm with you. I mean, the language, because you're having English readers, so why not have it actually in English? If you wanted to put a word or two in here or there, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but to try to make it sound like Shakespeare or something, that would be ridiculous.
Exactly.
When you were researching, didn't you find the Middle Ages to be a very, very dark and depressing time?
Well, for me, not really, because I love that time period.
Horrible
that sounds, but I love swords and stuff like that, but I don't agree with some of the things that happened, but I don't look at it from that point of view. I'm more of I like the fantasy aspect of it, you know.
The castle.
I like
the
castles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't like the politics of it, because this is going to sound crazy. I kind of agree with Dracula on this, Vlad the Impaler. I'm a king. What I say goes. If, you know, the church is putting pressure on the king to do what we say, and that's why Vlad actually killed one of them. He was like, look, I'm the king. What I say goes. You do what I say.
Okay.
If you don't like it, I'll impale you. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't agree with that. No second party should be telling the king what to do. You know, and that's
right.
Why you had a lot of people being killed for religious reasons and all this other stuff, you know.
Right. Because, ever since before the Council of Nicene in 300-something, I mean, the church, and then it was the church, and then later it became the Catholic after, you know, Martin Luther sprung off and all that. But the church has always been involved in telling governments what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is funny, because a lot of people don't realize that the Catholic Church, the Vatican, and Rome were the very same people who used to throw Christians to the lions for our fun when they worshiped the sun.
That it's so political.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I had people tell me that, well, in religion, there's no politics in religion. And,
oh, believe me, there's politics in religion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just like wanting to shake them until, you know, the brain settles in, because how can you say that? Oh, religion is completely political. I mean, there's some spiritual aspects to it, too, but so much religion has the politics. It's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it never is.
No. But now, so you really liked the time of the Middle Ages. Would that be your favorite time in history then? Or not?
Well, I tried to make it I tried to keep it grounded in reality, but I did add a little bit of romanticism to it so it wouldn't be so, you know, depressing.
Right.
But I wasn't writing about England and about certain, I was writing about Dacia, Romania, in the 8th century. So it's dark, but it's a different type of dark. They were still going through their own thing, but I tried to make it more about, you know, this character's life and what he's going through, and you're on this epic adventure of, you know, he's trying to avenge his family, and he's got this curse to deal with, and he's using it for everyone else. Not for him, you know. He's not looking at it as I'm cursed. You know what I'm saying? He's like, I'm going to use it to kill this person. Well, not even a person, but this thing,
right,
and to aid people, because my mother, told me to. So that's what he's doing, and that's kind of how I put it. And the way so many people tell me, oh my goodness, you wrote it so, you know, I love it because you make me feel like I was there living it with him. And that's kind of what my goal was, my objective was to make you look at it in a totally different way.
Yeah. And
so I guess I kind of achieved it.
Yeah, I would say, you know, what I had been talking about it being, well, the Middle Ages were after that. I mean, it was the 8th century. But, I mean, I always think of the, more than the castles, I think of the hovels that the peons lived in. But do you have any of that in the books, or is it mostly the castle people dashing around with the swords and things?
It's mostly just, I have a few things where he runs into a few priests and they kind of are afraid of him. He's like, look, just open the door. And he's like, why? And he's like, because if I wanted you dead, you'd be dead already, basically. he does fight with a sword, but he mostly uses his powers of being a lycanthrope, and whenever he's in wolf form, he really use any weapon but strength and claws and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't really use the political aspect in it. There's one part that was going to be, I think, but I might have gotten rid of it. My girlfriend's still mad at me about that, I think. where he basically just dethroned the king, just walked in there and took it off of his head and said, you don't deserve to be king, you're an idiot. And everybody was like, because you know they wanted him to be their king, and he was like, no, I don't want that responsibility, because he knows what came with it. You know, he's like, I got other things to do.
If all the kings that were idiots were taken out, I mean, there wouldn't be any left, or leaders, countries, or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, get rid of the idiots. My God, we're leaderless. But then we should hopefully have somebody with sense in the position. But you definitely change the world when you go around getting rid of the idiots.
Yeah.
But so he didn't want the title. He didn't want to be that kind of a leader.
No, he didn't want that kind of responsibility because he knew it would. That's all his life would end up being, would be this and that, and go talk to this guy, and he's like, I don't want that.
Right. Him from doing what his mission is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But now, also, you mentioned vampires. Have you been writing very much about them or researching them very much?
Oh, yes. I had to do just as much research about them as I did about werewolves.
Okay.
And
well, vampires
pretty much
have...
goes... Yeah, it goes back to the same... beginning, pretty much.
Really? Same.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now they're quite popular now, or they have been in the last few. More so than werewolves, I believe.
Yeah, they have been. They've always kind of enjoyed a popularity, and the reason why is because they, for some reason, I don't know why, but they always kind of sexualize the vampire, which is funny because the vampire really originally was not a creature of sexual appeal. It was basically a walking corpse that would bite you and drain your blood. That's it. You know, it wasn't attractive. It was pretty disgusting.
Right.
Dracula was the one who kind of brought sex appeal and class to it. Yeah, with Bram Stoker.
Right.
But the legend of vampirism or anything like that goes back to the legend of Lilith, which is, a lot of people might go, who's that? Some people might go, I know who that is, or, you know. Adam's first wife.
Right, before Lilith, yeah.
Before Eve, yeah. She decided that she didn't want to be subservient to him. And basically, she didn't want to be the lay under him in a missionary position. So she said, "We're equal." And he said, "I don't want to be on top." Or he said, "I don't want to be on the bottom." And she said, "Well, I don't want to be on the bottom." So she left him, and basically slept with Samael, an archangel. Some people say Lucifer. Doesn't matter. And they ended up together for a short while, but for their union or whatever, they were punished, and she was made infertile, so she couldn't have any children. So they couldn't have any children together, so she left him, and she started basically going around to men and mating with human men to try to become pregnant and biting them and draining their blood, which is why her name Lilith in ancient Hebrew means night creature or night monster or night hag or screech owl or any translation thereof. And in Greek, her name means, her name translates to Lilith means Lamia or child killer, which is why she hates children, because she can't have her own.
Oh.
Yeah. She also has different conflicting origins. Some say she's the daughter of Hecate.
Okay.
Yeah. And some say that she's like a half snake, half woman creature. She's a woman from the waist up and a snake from the waist down. I read a horror novel about that a long time ago.
Wow.
But,
never heard
yeah,
of that.
Her children were killed by Hera because she slept with Zeus. So Zeus gave her the ability to... She already had the vision of sight or something like that. She had psychic ability. So Hera turned her into a snake or something like that, and then Zeus took pity on her and had it where she could take her eyes out or something like that. But that's what it means in Greek. It's child killer because she likes to kill children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it goes all the way back to her, vampirism or, you know, killing children or drinking blood or whatever. So it's almost like they're both hand in hand. So that's why I'm going to use her and Cain as the pretty much the origins of both species in my fourth novel, which is Creatures of the Night or Children of the Night.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's going to have both. That's going to be very interesting. Are they going to be friends or adversaries? Or do you want to tell us?
Well, I haven't decided. Well, they're going to eventually both species will be adversaries, but I haven't decided whether they're going to be allies at first or what.
Yes, I love how I think you write, because you let the characters make the story. Instead of you saying, well, I'm going to have this and this and this and this, and this is the way it's going to turn out, you pretty much get into your characters, and they actually tell the story.
They do. They do. They tell me the way that the story is going to happen, and sometimes it fights me. It really does. I've had to actually start over. It happened to me on the second book, and it's happened to me on the third book, where it just... It wasn't happening, and I was like, I don't like the way this is. It don't feel right, and I had to actually stop and restart the whole book over, and then it just flowed, and I was like, this is better. This is right, because it fought against me. I was like, this is just terrible. This is not what it wants.
I love it, because, well, basically, this is another form of channeling that you're doing. Because
I suppose so.
Yeah, because you're just sort of opening it up. It's like, okay, I have these kind of characters in this general time frame, and, you know, they're going to maybe do this, this, and this. And then you sit down, and they take over when you let them, and then you have the book. But like you said, for the second and third one, maybe you were trying to control them too much or something. It didn't seem right.
The books just kind of write themselves, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't write unless I feel it. Because some people, you know, my girlfriend would be like, why aren't you writing? I'm like, because I'm not in the mood, you know.
Yeah.
if I force it, it feels forced, it and it comes out stiff.
Yeah.
But if I'm in the mood, man, it'll just be like, I write 4, 5, 6, 10 pages. Sometimes I can write a whole chapter in a day.
Yeah. Because of the way you write, you're not somebody who's up at 6 and writing till 10, and then you just go about your business, and then when the urge strikes you, you sit and write. You don't try to say, okay, this week I'm going to turn out so many pages or so many words.
Not really. I try to write as much as I can, but if the mood don't hit me, it just ain't happening. I don't write. If it hits me, I'm on it. You know, that's just the way I write. It's always been that way.
Well, if aside from the times when you're heavily researching, what has been the longest time you've gone not writing?
But how long has it been since I went without writing?
Yeah, how long
you mean
did
between,
you?
You mean between books?
No, while you're writing, well, yeah, that too. But while you're writing a book and you've got most of the research done, how long is the longest time? I mean, have you written for a couple of weeks or?
Oh, goodness. Well, let's see. I've gone to like, probably 2 or 3 weeks but in between writing because I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, what's going to happen? Like, you know, it ends on a cliffhanger, and I'm like, okay, now what's going to happen? And it just nothing. Bam, something hit me, and I was like, aha. And then as far as in between books, the longest time that I went between writing the books was between the second and third book because, so far I've had trouble with my computer, stuff like that.
That's always a problem. Yeah.
Between the first and the second book, I had problems because of Hurricane Katrina. My computer crashed twice. I restarted over because the book was going in the wrong direction. I was going through the cowboy time era, and I'm like, what am I doing? I don't even like the cowboy time era. So I stopped and rewrote it, and it just flowed much better.
Yeah, that's funny. It's like, why am I doing this? I don't even like it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm one of the people that I don't like the heat and I don't like the desert. I'm like, I don't see how them people drank whiskey back then in the desert. That would kill me. here I was writing about it. I'm like, what am I doing? So I was like, no, this is – and then the computer crashed. So I said, when I finally got up and running, I was like, okay, I'm going to restart over and go the right way. And I did it. And the computer crashed again. And just as I got up and running, I had all my health issues with my health, my heart, and all that. And then Hurricane Katrina hit. And then I was without a computer for like a year or so before I could even send what I was. I had the time to type it up and write it, but I didn't have the time to, the way to send it because I had no internet access. So it took me like 3 or 4 years before I could even send it to the publisher.
Wow. Well, how easy has it been to get published, Rusty? See, has it been to get published?
Well, it depends. I mean, well, right now I'm waiting for my contract to become void.
okay.
Because of money issues. But I got my eye on a new publisher that's perfect for my books because of the name of the publisher. Hopefully they'll do a better job. I think they will.
Okay.
But we'll see. But
What about self-publishing?
Excuse me?
What about self-publishing?
That's what these two books are, self-publishing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still have to deal with, people and, like, not real happy with the, the one. Well, I hope this next one is much more helpful to you.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. When do you think this book's going to be done?
I have no idea. As soon as I can get it done, that's all I can say.
Well, that's probably a good thing then to self-publish, because you don't have somebody yelling at you that you've got 3 months left and you better get it done.
I wouldn't operate very good under pressure like that.
Yeah, I think not, because you, like you said, you just can't. You don't sit down at a certain time every day or anything. You wait till the muse hits, and then you. What's the longest period you've like sat at the computer? In a day or in a day and a half or whatever. I mean, like with your girlfriend bringing you something to eat or drink. I mean, when you're on a roll.
Oh, goodness.
I have
sat at the computer before and typed up my second book for 12 hours and 54 minutes before.
12
without
hours
a break.
Oh, no, without a break at all. Oh, no.
Without a break, only going to the break, only going to the bathroom and to get something to eat, and I think that was it, pretty much.
Wow. Okay. Well, 12 hours and 54 minutes at the computer is plenty of time to actually just be there typing away. I mean, we're not playing on the computer or anything, but just typing. Wow. Yeah. But usually when you write, and I know that it just depends on when the spirit moves and all that, but give me an approximate average of the time. When you sit down, do you maybe write for a couple hours? Or, like you said, sometimes you write a whole chapter. Is there an average amount of time that you spend there?
Well, what I do is I handwrite out, like with a pen and paper, the whole book.
Right.
Then I go and type it, because I don't want to go and be trying to write 4 or 5 drafts of it, because it's going to be thick. I usually do 2 drafts, a handwritten draft, and I make my corrections on the type draft. That way I can fix punctuation, spelling, missing words, things like that. And then while I'm doing it, I might just decide I'm going to put a paragraph in between this sentence. And add some more depth to the story, or take this out, or whatever. And that way I can make whatever I want to do with it. And I was telling my girlfriend the other day, we were laughing about it. I said, the first book, handwritten, is way thicker than the second book, handwritten. But the second book, typed, is way thicker than the first book, typed.
Well, that's funny. How did that happen? That's weird.
It just happened that way. Yeah.
Well, that is, No, I'm like you. I mean, I'm not writing a book, although I guess there's one in the works. But I everything is longhand, paper and pen.
Mm-hmm.
And because I have friends who compose quite well on the computer and all that. But I don't know. I like something about that other deal myself. And like you say, then when you're typing it on the computer, then this is a major edit. So whether it's punctuation, it's adding the sentences, adding the paragraph, rearranging things. But it's funny how different. But I've heard about a lot of authors that actually longhand it out.
Thing is, I thought I was the only person that did that.
No, there's more.
I was shocked.
I'll read things online, and of course I read things online, but when it comes to reading a book or studying a book, I want it in my hands, and I don't mean a Kindle. I want the actual book, and I'm that way when
too.
I write. I want that tactile. I want that touch.
Smell.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's nothing like the smell of a bunch of books and paper. I mean, ever since I was a child, I mean, all kinds of paper and pens and pencils. I mean, I'm absolutely nutty when it comes to, I've got, notebooks, notebooks.
I love the smell of a library.
yeah. But yes, I have a girlfriend who's, she likes the paper stuff too. And I mean, you get us in a shop and it's just like, oh, this is sad because, we're buying up notebooks and paper. We don't know what we're going to use it for, but it feels good. It smells good. It looks good. So, That, yeah, that and dishes and books are my things. But no, no, whatever. But everybody has to have something that they get that way. What kind of advice would you give somebody who's, you know, well, any kind of writing, but especially in this genre, like dark fantasy and horror? What would you tell them?
With any genre, depending on what you're writing, I'd say do your research, know your subject, write with authority, know what your subject is, and write what you like. You know, write what you like. If you like it, write about it. If you like cars, write about cars. If you like whatever, you know, sea serpents, write about sea serpents or pirates or whatever.
Yeah.
But do your research. You can't just go willy-nilly and write it. You have to make sure that you're putting realism in there, or people are not going to believe it. So
right.
Make sure that you do that.
Probably
and
now
that's with
more
any
than
genre,
ever.
Be it drama or romance or horror or anything.
Yeah, know your subject. And don't you think that now with the internet, that's even more important, because people are much more sophisticated about these topics. So if you're...
Yes, it is.
You know, way off the wall. I mean, just making up all this stuff as you go, people are going to call you on it. And I mean, it's
oh,
like,
yeah.
No. You didn't do your research. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, another thing that I've noticed a lot of people in Hollywood seem to do, and I would suggest you not do. If you establish a set of rules in this universe that you're creating, I don't care what it is, stick to them. Don't break them for the sake of telling a story, because it's a quick way to do it. Like, this will kill them, but for the sake of the story, it doesn't. Do you get what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
If you establish a set of rules, stick to it. Because
that is good.
In the real world, if you get shot with a bullet, it will kill you. You know,
it will kill you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense, because I've heard of, well, and seen in movies and all, that there's exceptions. They make exceptions.
Exactly.
And they don't make sense. But then in the movies, because it's at the end, and you say, well, yeah, they did that because they're going to have a part two or something,
yeah.
You know.
And it's like, they went all the way there, and it's like, I've seen people point out, it's like, well, if they did that, then why are they there? They could have just done this. Wouldn't it have been simpler? Oh, yeah, you're right. Why didn't they do that? For the sake of telling the story. You know, I don't try to do that. I try to make sure that there's either a problem or they do it the easy way, because I put more stuff in there. You know?
Well, right. So, because
so,
you're more in depth. I mean, you're not writing just a little story that somebody's just going to be telling around the campfire. I mean, unless they're a very good storyteller and go into depth. It's because you have avenues in your stories. So
yes.
There's choices and options for people. But then, like, I like that you mentioned that. Stick with the rules. I mean, you're the one that's creating the rules in the story. So
exactly.
You know.
Make I'm just saying, Hollywood's really bad about doing that. They'll come up with what they, like they say, like, it's the main, let's say the villain's Achilles heel. This will kill him, or this will destroy him. And at the end of the movie, they use it. They so-called destroy him. And at the end of the movie, there's an epilogue where it shows him kill the main good guy. And you're like, ugh, and then they roll the credits. I'm like, bull crap, because that's breaking their rules. You can't do that. You know, you got to establish a rule that stick to them. If it destroys him, he's done. He's done. That's it. The end.
Right.
You know, and off to the sunset they go. Or whatever.
Right.
Or if you don't want to do that, have it where the hero fails and they die. You know? But you can't say one thing and then do something and then or break it and then say, well, he killed him anyway. You know?
Right. You're the one that set the rules. So at the end of the book, I mean, you know, you've not got to publish yet, and if you want this, you can go back and change some rules before you end the story.
Because yeah, exactly.
It's your rules. You're the one that set them up, and you can change a couple things along the way, or maybe more. But yeah, don't let it go out where it's is going against what you've already stated are the rules. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
So are all your books now, you started out writing the story for your girlfriend and she suggested it. So are they all for her now, or are you dedicating them to other people or what?
Well, yeah, they're all for her. But I've started adding some other dedications in there since some certain people passed away in my life, my mother and different ones, because she got me interested in books and all of that. So, you know, with each book, it's like, you know, to Mary and to my mother and to this one and that one and different people who helped or whatever, you know.
Right. Because nobody really does it all on. I mean, you have some kind of help or encouragement along the way. It's it's good to credit the people. But does your girlfriend ever say, "Hey, in one of your books upcoming, why don't you have your characters do this or this?" Does she?
Oh my God, does she ever? She don't be quiet. She's not quiet about it. She's always telling me, "Look, this is the way it is." I'm like, no, we have arguments about it. So, yeah, she's very vocal about what's going on in the book.
Okay. Well, see, that's you started it out writing the story for her like she wanted. And so,
Oh, yeah, she don't like the way something is. She'll tell me really quick.
Have you ever said, look, Mary, look, now I'm writing this. This is what my character's doing. And
yeah, and she'll be like, I don't care. This is what I said, and this is what you're going to do. So
okay,
I have to kind of
– well, I guess
we
know.
I kind of do what she said.
Well.
Yeah, it's for her. Yeah, I have to make Mama happy, so.
Has she ever been just really, really wrong about a character? That anybody,
I can't say no. She's never really been wrong about a character. She actually is pretty right, actually, most of the time.
Okay. So it's a good thing to listen, then.
Yeah. I've actually done, been headstrong, but no, I'm going to do it my way, and then find out that, you know, other people were like, well, actually, that was a pretty good idea. And I was like, oh, I should have done that. So.
Okay, well, so that's what keeps the relationship all happy. She has an opinion, she voices it, and you listen. So I like that. I want to say that, once again, that you can be found at phantomwolf.wix.com/Rusty Nugent. And also, you had mentioned your health issues. I just wanted to say that you were a drummer before. Not that you're not now, but you don't drum as extensively as you used to.
Yeah,
so.
I really haven't drummed in a while. Been about it's been over a year, about a year and a half.
Yeah, but where the drumming was one of your passions, but the writing is also.
Yeah.
So you're fortunate in that you have, you know, another avenue to go down. And I think you're just getting started, really, aren't you? Because you've got so much research. Yeah, well, you've got so much research.
I'd like to be.
And, I think so. So just, well, keep us informed, and we'll have you back. You can talk to someone. And all that. So I want to wish you a good Friday today, like George reminded me, and happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
Yeah. I don't have any children, so mine are all four-legged, so we're not going to do the Easter egg thing. But,
well, I have two four-legged ones, and I got two grown ones running around, so.
I used to like to do the Easter eggs, but, times have changed. So, thank you so much, Rusty.
Thank you for having me.
Weekend.
Yes.
See you next time. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.